God is dead, declared Nietzsche. God is a crutch for the weak, said Marx. Bigots and dinosaurs is how Nick Clegg describes those who believe in God and in turn infers that God is a dinosaur and bigoted. How do you deal with those who defy God? How do you deal with those who dishonor his name and dishonor his people? How do you respond when your friend, your family member, uses Jesus' name as a swear word or dishonors him in some way? How do you respond? In fear? Not a literal trembling, but fearing you may offend if you say something. Fearing a break in the relationship. How do you respond to God's name, his character, his honor being maligned and defiled? Are you concerned? Is it a concern that leads to action, or are you fearful that if you say something, do something, it may lead to trouble or to a broken relationship or to hassle or just to harm even? How do you respond? Well, we see in 1 Samuel 17 how David responds to such speak. And we see in verses 1 to 11 a God-defying giant. A God-defying giant. See, the scene is set. The armies are facing each other. On one hill are the Philistines. They have all the modern equipment, the latest armor. They're well trained, they're well drilled. They look good, they look impressive. On the other side are the Israelites. Not so impressive, not wearing the latest armor, made up of farmers and fishermen and perfumers and whoever else they could find to come and join the battle. One side stands a professional army, one side stands an army made up, well, of hicks. And in the middle is the Valley of Elah. And the Valley of Elah is significant because it's the valley through which the Philistines could enter Israel. If Israel don't win, Philistines will have unguaranteed access or guaranteed access into Israel whenever they like. Raiding parties would just be able to enter. Armies would be able to march into Israel anytime. It's significant, this battle. Philistines on one side, Israel on the other side. And out from the Philistines comes their champion, a giant, a man called Goliath. And he is 9 feet tall. He's as tall as I am now, give or take a few inches. And he's a brute of a man. I mean, you know, he makes me look thin. He is wide. Yeah, you might dare to call him chubby to his face, but you probably couldn't reach his face. So you stand in fear at this man. And his armor is impressive. His armor weighs 14 stone. That's more than I weigh. He is carrying me around on his back with ease. And his sword on his back is impressive and mighty. And his spear, oh, his spear is big. And more than that, the thing on the top, the head, weighs 15 pounds. It's like a bowling ball on a spear. But you don't want a bowling ball on a spear, but it weighs. And he is standing there. He is a tank on legs. And he comes out. And his armor is shining and glistening in the early morning sun. And he begins to gob off to Israel. He begins to shout the abuse. Come on out, if you think you're hard enough. I'll fight you. Come on, send someone out. I want to fight. If he wins, we'll be your slaves. But if I win, you will be our slaves. Come on out, I dare you. And they all tremble. And he continues. He says, verse 10, I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man to fight. I defy. And in effect, what he's saying is, I defy the armies of the living God. That's what David will say in verse 26. He's defying the armies of the living God. In effect, Goliath stands out and he says to the armies of Israel and to King Saul this. He's basically saying, you are pathetic and you're weak, just like your God. Just like your king. And I am mighty and I'm strong and I'm powerful like my God and my army that is standing, looking, menacing behind him. And it's no wonder that Israel trembles with fear. Verse 11, and King Saul is quaking as he sees this giant, as he sees the Philistines. They're fearful. But you see, having been introduced to the God-defying giant, this beast of a man, and having seen Israel's response, well, we're then introduced to a God-honoring shepherd. God-honoring shepherd. Verse 12 through to verse 40. Have a look at verse 12. Now David was the son of a Paphrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was old and well advanced in years. His 3 eldest sons had followed Saul to war, Eliab and Abinadab and Shammah. And David was the youngest. And then we know verse 15. David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And I think verse 15 is there to link us back with what we saw last week in chapter 16, how David, the anointed one, has gone to serve Saul by playing the harp every time Saul gets this evil spirit from the Lord upon him. And what we're seeing is that what happens is David is spending some time in Bethlehem tending his sheep, but when Saul needs him, he's going to be with Saul. And so he seems to be flicking backwards and forth between Saul and Bethlehem. Just as when Saul didn't need him, he was in Bethlehem. And so having kind of been introduced or reintroduced and reminded of David and what had happened, we're then, verse 16, reminded of the situation. And we're reminded that the situation is desperate. See, for 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and every evening and took his stand. Every day, twice a day, Goliath would defy Israel and defy Israel's God. And for 40 days, this standoff had gone on. And so the resources of the impoverished king were severely being strained. And individual families throughout Israel were now beginning to struggle. They were struggling because they were without their male adults. Their husbands and their brothers and their sons were all off at war. And it was the harvest time. And so it was difficult to harvest because all the menfolk were at the battle. And more than that, these families were having to supply the menfolk with food and their supplies for what they needed. Things were not good. Resources are limited. The situation is getting desperate. And the God-defying giant has not gone away. And so verse 17. Jesse sends his youngest son David to the Israelite camp with supplies for his brothers and to get an assurance of their well-being. And David leaves early in the morning, verse 20. Now, presumably he leaves early because he wants to get back before night, get back to guarding the sheep that he's left with another shepherd. But his early start means he arrives at the battle line as the battle lines are being drawn for the day. And so David dumps the supplies and he runs and rushes to the battle lines to greet his brothers. And he begins to speak with them, you know, speaking to Eliab and Abinadab and Shammah. How are you doing? How's it going, guys? Seen any action yet? What's happening? And as he's catching up and telling them about how he saved a sheep the other day, Goliath appears. The God-defying giant comes out. And he shouts his usual defiance against Israel and against Israel's God. And here's the thing. David hears it. And then David sees the Israelites' response. He sees that upon hearing Goliath, that they run, that they're terrified, that this army of the living God runs. And Saul runs, and they retreat in great fear, and they run like a rabbit from a fox. And then as they reassemble, they begin talking to one another, and David overhears their chatter. So verse 25, you can imagine these soldiers, can't you, talking, did you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. Oh, but the king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. Oh, and he'll give him his daughter in marriage. And he'll exempt his father's family from taxes. Oh, I'm thinking of going for it. Really? No. And David, hearing this, speaks, verse 26. He speaks. And it's the first time in the narrative. It's the first time in the Bible that David has spoken. See, up to this point, David has been a literary mute. He's never said a word. He's not said a word when he's been anointed. He's not said a word when he's faced Saul's spears or the evil spirit and played the harp. Not a word so far. Now, there are some people who pretty much talk nonstop. You can probably think of some. They have a comment, a thought on everything, even if it's not required. That they effectively have verbal diarrhea. And the only response to such a person is to kind of, you tune them out. You stop listening to them. But there are others who are quiet, they're thoughtful, they're reflective. And it's not because they're shy, but they simply don't thrive on hearing themselves. And when that friend speaks, in some discussion or on some issues, what happens? We all listen. Because you assume that their words will be weighty and important, at least for them. And so when David speaks for the first time, we are to listen. His words are as weighty as Goliath's whole body and armor. I mean, look what he says, verse 26. What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And David, in his speech, is now injecting godly questions into the episode. He's injecting the theology of what is happening. You see, David's sitting there going, doesn't having a living God make a difference in all of this? I mean, this giant has mocked the ranks of the living God. And if the living God is so identified with Israel, do you think he's indifferent towards such slurs on his reputation? Do you expect a living God to allow an uncircumcised Philistine to trample his name? I mean, Israel and Saul thinking that this giant is undefeatable and invulnerable. And for David, well, it's merely a gobby, uncircumcised disgrace. See, faith in the living God gives a whole new view of things. A faith in the living God gives you a whole new view of things. You begin to see things very clearly. David's oldest brother, though, hears David talk with the men, verse 28, and he burns with anger towards David. And possibly because he's fearful himself and is now a little bit afraid that his little brother might show him up. I mean, the last thing you want is your baby brother being a hero when you're a chicken. And so he rebukes David. Verse 28, you left the sheep to come and watch men die. You wicked, conceited little man. But David's not fazed. And he responds effectively, verse 29, what have I done to offend you? I happen to have been asking about a very important matter. And with that, David continues talking to the men. And as he talks, this chatter with the men is now overheard. And Saul sends for him. The king has heard of this shepherd boy who has begun to speak with the big, bold language. And so David boldly goes up to the king. And I love this bit, verse 32. And the New Living Translation translates it like this. It says, do not... This is David to Saul. Do not worry about a thing. Love that. I mean, if David had been born a few centuries later, he'd have sung a song. Don't worry about a thing, cause... That's it. That's the point. Verse 30, that's the point. David has gone up to Saul. Don't worry about a thing, because every little thing is going to be all right. I'll go and fight. Don't let your heart worry. I'll go and fight. And Saul sees this shepherd boy and he says to him, but you are but a boy. Now, David was probably in his teens. He kind of been much older. If he was 20, he would have been eligible to be in the battle, on the military. You had to be 20 to go and be part of the army. And so here's a teenage boy before the king of Israel. And he speaks once more. And yet again, we are to listen, because yet again, his words are theologically rich and theologically true. In fact, he says what the king should have been declaring and should have realized. And it will all be too apparent who is the anointed and who has the spirit and who has not. And in David's speech, we begin to see why he says, do not worry. And it's not because he's arrogant, it's not because he's conceited, it's not because he's proud, it's not because he's boastful. It's because he has faith. Verse 34, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by the hair, I struck it and I killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This gobby, uncircumcised Philistine will be just like one of them, because he has defiled the armies of the living God. Goliath is no more than an uncouth beast. And verse 37 is the key. Have a look. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. See, David does not ascribe his escapes to luck or skill or to audacity. No, it's the Lord who delivered him. And as David looks back in faith, it enabled him to look forward in faith. God will deliver him from the Philistine just as God delivered him from the beasts. See, Saul and Israel had forgotten that God delivers, that he had delivered them from Nahash and from the atrocities of the Ammonites. But David does not forget how God has delivered him over and over and over again. And how often we forget God's deliverance. And so, like Saul and like Israel, we fear what is before us, because we forget his deliverances of us. And David, having spoken these words, Saul says to him, verse 32, the king of Israel lets a teenage boy go and fight the God-defying giant they're all scared of. Go. Go. And the Lord be with you. And Saul generously or out of guilt offers David his armor, but it's too much for David, so he declines it. And in some way, his actions are a rejection of the type of king Saul is. See, Saul's a king of glamour and looking outwardly impressive. David is not wooed by such things. David is more like the great leaders of the past, Abraham and Moses. Not outwardly impressive, but has a heart after God's. And so he takes his staff in his hand and he chooses 5 smooth stones, probably the size of tennis balls. And he puts them in his pouch and he takes his sling and he walks out to fight the God-defying giant. And we get the battle, verse 41 to 58. And as David walks out, Goliath despises him and despises him. What am I, a dog? That you send me out a stick? I am Goliath, the champion of the Philistines. I am a brute of a man, and you send me out a boy? And he begins to hurl insults down on David, and he begins to hurl insults again at Israel, and he threatens David that he'll be eaten by the beast of the earth and the birds of the sky. And David, hearing all this and seeing this giant, God-defying giant, doesn't run, doesn't tremble. No, he merely speaks. And once more, we are to listen. Have a look at this, verse 45. Standing before Goliath, you have come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. This day, the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down, and I'll cut off your head. Today, I will give the carcass of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know, Goliath, that there is a God in Israel. And all those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. The God of hosts, the God Goliath that you ridicule, will show what puny powers you serve. Will show how puny Goliath's gods are, the gods that he has cursed David with. See, Goliath might come with a sword on his back and a spear that weighs the same as a bowling ball. And he might even have a javelin. But before this day is over, everyone, Israel, Philistines, all the nations that ever read this text, all will know that God does not save by sword or spear. God will give victory. And he'll do it through what the world deems weakness. He'll do it through a teenage boy and his sling. And David, having spoken, now acts. And Goliath moves to attack, and David runs quickly, and he reaches into his bag, and he takes out a stone, and he slings it, and it strikes the Philistine on the forehead. And the stone, which has probably traveled at over 100 miles per hour like a gunshot, sinks into the God-defying giant's forehead. And the giant falls like a tree being cut down. And so, verse 50, David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone without a sword in his hand. For the Lord does not save by sword or spear. And as if to kind of underline that, David then takes Goliath's sword and cuts off his head. The God-defying giant is slain. And with their champion lying dead, the Philistines run. And they're conquered and they're plundered by an army that is now no longer fearful. The battle belongs to the Lord. And all now know that the living God resides in Israel. And with the battle won, Saul wants then to reward David. And so we get verse 55 to 58. Saul gets Abner to find out whose son David is. Three times this is asked. Verse 55, verse 56, verse 58. Whose son? Whose son? Whose son? Because note, he does not ask who David is, but whose son he is. Saul knows who David is. He wants to know who his father is, presumably so that he can exempt the family from taxes as he had promised. And David, the slaying, God-defying giant slayer, stands before Saul and says, I am the son of your servant, Jesse, of Bethlehem. So what? So what? It's a good story. But what does it mean to us today? Well, I think there's two lessons that we can learn from this. Firstly, this concern for a God who is defied. A concern for a God who is defied. Defy is the word of this passage. It's repeated six times throughout this passage. It's repeated verse 10, verse 23, verse 25, verse 26, verse 36, verse 45. In other words, at the heart of this chapter is that Israel's God is being defiled. His name is being dragged through the valley of Elah's mud. And it's being done so by an uncouth Philistine giant. And it's only David who seems to be concerned with this. Only David who seems concerned to turn away Goliath's mocking and derision of Israel. It's only David who seems to recognize that mocking Israel is to mock Israel's God, verse 26. And what's striking is that David reasserts this defiance of God every time he speaks, in each of his major speeches, verse 26, verse 36, verse 45. The driving concern of the chapter is the honor of God's name, of God's reputation, of God's glory. David is driven by a passion for the honor of God, verse 47, for God's name to be known. You see, the focus of the passage is not on David, it's not on Saul, it's not on Goliath, it's not on a scared Israel, but it's on God. It's all about his honor and his name and his reputation and his glory. And effectively, David says to Israel, and in turn us, God's reputation, his honor is at stake. And that matters to me. And it matters enough to risk my life for it. What about you? What about you? Does it matter to you? David's greater grandson will have the same passion. That passion to see God glorified, given his life to achieve it. So we read how Jesus says, doesn't he? John 17, verse 4, I have brought you glory on earth, as he prays to his Father. I've brought you glory. I've come to do your will. Jesus' very purpose on earth was to come to do the Father's will and so bring him glory. And he'd do it amongst a world and a people that have dishonored and defiled God's name and God's glory. Jesus was passionate and concerned for the glory of God, for God's reputation, that he dies on a cross to bring glory to God. And so we read in Ephesians 1, verse 6, that Jesus came to the praise of God's glorious grace. Or verse 14, to the praise of his glory. And when Jesus taught his disciples to pray in Matthew 6, what did he teach his disciples to firstly pray? Hallowed be your name. Hallowed be your name. Because what is it that his disciples are to be concerned with? Seeing God's name honored, hallowed, set apart, holy. They're to be concerned with God's reputation in a world that rejects and that defies. And presumably Jesus was teaching his disciples how to pray based on what he prayed. You see, Jesus, like David, was passionate about the honor and the glory of God's name, of God's reputation. How concerned are you to see God's name and reputation not defied? Is our vision, our point of view, our desire the same as David's? The same as Jesus's? Can we say that that matters to us more than our advantage or our reputation or our security or our comfort? It matters. And of course, for us, it's not going to be played out in front of watching armies in a valley of Elah. No, more often it will be done in our homes, in our offices, our streets. It's going to be done when someone asks us as a church to marry two blokes or two ladies and will gently refuse, knowing their request opposes God's will, and knowing that as we refuse, it will anger the couple, it will anger their family, it will anger many in our neighbourhood and community, it will anger the press, that will be maligned and opposed and even ostracised. But what is more important? Our reputation, our comfort, or the Lord's honour, the Lord's name? Or what about in your workplace? Or the school gate, or over the fence, as your associate, your neighbour, your fellow parent uses God's name and that of his son as a swear word. And you'll take them aside and you'll confront the person about the matter, explaining that offending you does not matter, but offending God will. Will that person then think you worse than weird? Might you not face ridicule for your efforts? And yet whose honour matters? Or what about when a politician abuses and ridicules God's people and so ridicules the God we worship? See, will you be concerned enough to write? Or just merely outraged in your front room? Will you be concerned enough to say your words are offensive to the God I worship? Offending me and thousand like me is one thing, but offending God is quite another. See, the thing is, failure to speak, failure to challenge, to stand up for the honour of God will give the world the impression that our God is not the true living God, that he's merely a stone idol, just a God of an ancient book, just another myth. And David did not believe that, and Jesus did not believe that, and we don't believe that. We don't believe that we serve a stone idol. We believe that we serve the living God. And serving the living God surely must make a difference in standing up for him and seeing his name honoured in a world that often defies. So can you say, God, honour matters more to me than my advantage, my reputation, my security, my comfort, my effort? It did to David. It did to Jesus. Will it for you? And the reason that David was so prepared to give his life for the honour of God was because he had faith in God to deliver. See, secondly, a faith in God to deliver. We've seen David's faith, verse 37. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. We said, you know, David knows it was not his skill, it wasn't his luck, it wasn't his timing that brought him victory, but it was God who delivered him. And his looking back to the past deliverances enables him to look forward in faith. God will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. See, faith, here's the key bit, faith is sustained in the present and the future as it remembers God's provision in the past. Faith is sustained in the present and in the future as it remembers God's provision in the past. The rich history of God's past goodness nurtures faith in its current dilemma. If God saved me then, he can save me now. If God delivered me from beasts, then can he not deliver me from a giant gobby Philistine? And it's David's faith in God's deliverance that then drives him to fight for God's honour. And Jesus was similar. He placed his faith in his Father. Jesus knew that as he went to the cross, God would deliver him. God would vindicate him. The prophets had foretold it. He trusted his Father's word. He knew that he was his Father's delight, and so he placed his faith in him. So we read in Hebrews 12, verse 2, don't we? Looking to Jesus, the founder and the pioneer of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, the joy of being in heaven with his Father, the joy of being risen again, the joy of ruling as the king over everything, because he had that joy, because he had that deliverance, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of God. His faith in God to deliver led him to the cross in order to bring glory to his Father. And does not our ability to honor God's name arise from our faith in God to deliver? And not just God's deliverance of us at the cross, which of course, as we read 1 Samuel 17, we know that David's work as the anointed one defeating Goliath looks forward to when Jesus would defeat our greatest enemy, death and sin, by dying on a cross. We know that David is looking ahead to Jesus. And of course, we're to remember the cross as a great act of deliverance, as the deliverance. And of course, as we look at the cross, we see God's care and his love of us. We see our security and our comfort and our hope that arises from that. Absolutely. The cross is the deliverance that we look to. But we also need to remember his everyday deliverances. You know, those moments when God answers our prayers, when he delivers us right at the last moment, when we remember how that check that was needed arrived just minutes before the deadline, or the job comes just before the last day of the old one, or the money runs out, when he brings a healing against all odds at the last moment when everything else seems to have gone awry, when he intercedes or gets involved when we can't possibly have imagined and seems to have saved us or brought about a deliverance in our lives in just the everyday. Or think about when he saves your life from a nasty accident where you realize you're only inches or minutes or seconds away from death. If you'd been a minute late or seated a fraction over, you'd have died physically. And it's as we recall those deliverances, the little and the big, alongside the cross, it fuels our faith. It fuels our faith to risk our lives and our reputations and our comfort for his honor. Because we know he can and he will deliver, not just by the cross, but in all the other everyday episodes of our lives. And of course, he might not ever deliver how we envisage, but he will deliver, he will care, he will look after his people, he will not abandon them. He's demonstrated on the cross, and then he demonstrates over and over and over again his care for his people. And you might just need to buy a notebook to recall them if you're prone to forget. Because it's that moment of knowing, recalling the past. Because faith is sustained in the present and in the future as it remembers God's provision in the past. Be it the great deliverance, be it the everyday deliverances, the bears and the lions. And you see, it's David's faith that stirred him to act for the honor of God. And he did so in spite of weakness, in spite of looking weak, in spite of looking foolish to a watching world. His older brother, Eliab, looked at him and tells him he's a pain. Saul looks at him and says, "You're green." Goliath looks at him and says, "You're puny." And David steps out in faith because he knows it is God who delivers, bringing deliverance without the symbol of man's strength, without a sword, without a spear. See, what matters is not whether you have the best weapons, but whether you have the real God. And often God uses the weak and the foolish to bring him honor. Jesus looked weak. We will look weak to a watching world. But in spite of that, let's follow David's example and be those who are concerned for the honor of our God, because we know he is the living God. And we have faith that he will deliver as we seek to honor.